Hello, this is Lewis Lapham, and you're listening to Lapham's Quarterly Podcast. Wait, I can't breathe. There's Occupy Wall Street demonstrations outside my window, and the police are using pepper spray. Well, while Lewis chain smokes his way to freedom, we're going to steal the theme from the last issue of his quarterly. This is all about, that's right, food. In the second half of the show, the brave amongst us will dissect Neal Stephenson's new meta-thriller, Reamed-y. Or is it pronounced Reamed? I'll make a case for that. It's something of a departure from his other books, and there will be spoilers.
Ooh. Jesse's very good at that.
Yeah, so I don't care about spoilers.
Yeah, exactly. But first, who's here today?
Karen.
The Agnes B. of the Nashville Public Library.
Bill Chamberlain.
Crystal.
Jesse.
Amanda.
And Clint's in the booth with big headphones on. It's like Princess Leia, but not as sexy. Strange.
Twice as sexy.
So, but first, before we get started, we got to tell you what's going on in November. And since Jesse's on the wrong side of the table, Amanda.
Brian hired me for the gig. November's a pretty exciting month at the library. Yes, it's Thanksgiving, which was why we're talking about food. But also, you can join us for a free, rare public reading with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer John McPhee, coming up November 12th at 10 a.m. in the main library auditorium. And I believe this is it a ticketed event? Like, it's free, but you have to get a ticket to get in?
The first 200 or so people get tickets to be in the auditorium.
Right.
After that, you'll be in the overflow room.
Right.
So get here early.
Yeah, doors open at 9, so feel free to make your way down to the library on November 12th for John McPhee.
And the overflow room is like, you know, you get to see a live video feed, you know, of it, but it's not as... Yeah, Clint's giving a thumbs down. It's not the same, man.
You don't feel the presence of John McPhee.
I want to feel his spittle.
Magic.
I want to feel his spittle on me, you know? I'm a book dork. I got a thing for old white men with Coke bottle glasses.
Can you say that? You can't say that.
Him.
What do you mean?
I just did.
Him? Dr. Seuss?
Okay.
I just thought about something. Dr. Seuss and John McPhee are the same person. I'll put pictures in the show notes, guys. You'll see. Okay.
And is Nanny McPhee involved in this scenario at all?
Who's Nanny McPhee?
She's like Mary Poppins, but for our generation.
I had no parental guidance.
It's Emma Thompson, who played Nanny McPhee.
Listen.
Two movies.
I was watching Gummo. I don't know what that movie's about.
I'm going to bring Brian back down to earth with Nanny McPhee.
Okay. All right. Okay. Anyway. So, another movie that's not Nanny McPhee and not quite as horrifying as John McPhee's spittle. I've dug myself a hole. Bill will rescue me.
Well, come to the movies at Maine, Saturday, November 19, 2011, at 2 p.m. in our auditorium, the Nashville Public Library downtown, 615 Church Street, to see Brian De Palma's 1974 film Obsession. What is Obsession, you ask? Obsession is a love story that will scare the life out of you. Michael Corton's life is shattered when his wife and daughter are tragically killed in a botched kidnap rescue attempt. Many years later, while traveling to Italy, he meets and falls in love with the woman who bears his uncanny resemblance to his late wife. Brian De Palma directs this Hitchcock-inspired thriller starring Cliff Robertson, Genevieve Bugeaud, and John Lithgow. Now, very importantly, we've done an excellent podcast with the film's producer, George Leto. It's one of our better podcasts. Nothing that I did. It was all him. Tells all kinds of great behind-the-scenes stories of his days as an agent and producer in Hollywood. If you don't come to the screening, which you should, because you're going to miss it, it'll be projected Blu-ray on our big screen. But the George Leto interview is really great. So take it from there.
I've heard this podcast, you know, I have inside information, and, you know, you hear all kinds of dirt on Brian De Palma and Paul Schrader. It's awesome. You got to hear that one.
Okay, this is Amanda kicking off the cooking segment. So last month, I talked about church lady cooking. And so this month, I'm going to kind of go a little more mainstream with talking about Julia and I can't ever say it right, Julie and Julia, which was made into a movie in 2009 starring Meryl Streep and Amy Adams. But before that, it was a book called Julie and Julia by Julie Powell. And before that, it was a blog. I think it may have been called The Julie Project at some point, but then she changed it to Julie and Julia. Julie Powell, I'm going to get those names mixed up every time, so stay with me, folks. Julie Powell decided to cook through every recipe in Julia Child's book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, which includes 524 recipes. The nastiest one is called aspic, and basically you make that by boiling horse's hooves. And, like, it makes jelly, or, like, jello, but, like, horse hoof flavored jello. And then you put, like, meat in it. And there's a bunch of these, and I don't know why anyone would ever make this.
That's where your jello comes from. It's just
it's
done
just
in a factory.
Gelatin and then
food coloring. Yeah. See, that's what gelatin is.
That's the kind I like. I'm not going to boil my own hooves to make jello. So, anyway, in the film, actually, they instead of doing in the book, Julie Powell kind of makes up her own story of Julia Child's life, and in the film, Nora Ephron, the director, actually takes Julia Child's book, My Life in France, and inserts those moments into where Julie Powell had her made-up portions, which I think makes for a stronger narrative. I actually liked the movie better, which I hardly ever say that. The book is almost always better. But in this case, the movie was better because I think that Amy Adams made a better Julie Powell than Julie Powell did. I saw the movie first, and then I read the book, and I thought that Julie Powell was kind of... I'm trying to think of a nice way to say...
Mean.
Thank you. Karen chimed in for me because we kind of talked about that. She just, I don't know, she just kind of was not the personality I was hoping for. So my suggestion to you is to watch the movie, read the book if you want, feel free to make aspic in your free time. And I know that Karen, when we talked, she said that My Life in France was really good, so...
It's excellent.
Yeah, so she would recommend you pick that one up as well. So Brian, what have you been cooking?
My only cooking story is, like, I cut my lip drinking, like, the hot dog juice from the sausages that come in a can at the dollar store. You know, so I got a cold sore from that. That's my only culinary story. And when they do make the movie about me, Christian Bale will be the better me. That's all I'm going to say. It's just going to happen. But, or that's just the way, well, it's probably not going to happen. That's just the way that's just the way it'll work out, right?
You do look like Christian Bale, so that's okay.
This is audio.
Like,
so
exactly. Like if we had this like genetically photocopied Christian Bale and there was Xerox degeneracy for like 10 generations, you might get me. You know, we're probably the same height, right?
Same personality.
Yeah. Male and the machinist? Or...
Yeah, I did, yeah, exactly. That was actually true. I haven't killed anyone in a long time.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about The Wind-Up Girl by Paolo Bacigalupi. And this was a science fiction novel that swept all the science fiction awards a couple years ago. And it's in not exactly a dystopian, but a future post-food crash Thailand. And that is the idea that genetically modified foods have created these food shortages, right? And then in Thailand, they've actually managed to keep their own, like, native non-genetically modified foods. There's this government agency called the White Shirts, and they keep out, like, the Agrigen Western businesses, right? And Agrigen stands for agricultural genetic businesses that want to import, like, their genetically modified food. Though the book, it's no Tree of Smoke or no Europe Central, but both sides are very morally ambiguous. Like, the government agency and the corporations, like, none of them are good. There are no good guys. That makes the book very interesting. The wind-up girl of the title is a genetically modified person. If you're looking for maybe a good follow-up to Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, I would recommend The Wind-Up Girl. And like most like really good like science fiction, it seems like it could be something that's very real. It's very scary. So check it out.
Okay, I have a quick comment.
Yeah.
Who do you think would win, White Shirts or the Brown Coats?
You mean brown shirts like Firefly brown shirts
brown
or like
coats.
Nazis?
The brown coats.
Brown coats.
Yeah.
Brown shirts. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just making sure.
I used to get those two mixed up myself.
Yeah, no, see, we're all brown coats here for Firefly, and that's what made me, when he said white shirts, and I thought brown coats.
We got to go back. I absolutely just assumed Nazis, right?
Oh,
I
was okay. Like, no,
I was
on the wrong side of the room.
I was in, like, I was in
real... Like brown coats all the way, but I'm not...
I know.
Did you come to our screening of Serenity?
I wasn't... I saw Serenity in the theater with a group of, like, 10 library dorks who were freaking out about it. You guys have no idea. That came out when I was in library school, and, like, you know, it was a big deal. But I was thinking about Nazis, and I think that they were kind of the same. Like, they were thugs with clubs. So, like, Nazi brown shirts is, you know, I mean, it's a pretty good metaphor. Who would win? No one really wins in the book. I mean, it's just kind of a cluster fudge. You know, it's like, it's not good, right?
So the brown coats would win because they have spaceships.
That's right.
That's true. Because there is some slight steampunk aspects in the book in the sense that there are no airplanes anymore. There's this idea that there's a not just a food shortage, but there's the idea of, like, there's an energy shortage. So, like, food is, like, calories. So there's a calorie shortage. Mm. Like, how many calories can you get? How many, you know? So there's the idea that, like, so for shipping, the world is sort of contracted in size because it takes a lot of energy to ship something from one part of the world to the other. If we have spaceships, we win, because they don't.
Yeah, spaceships win. Sorry, Karen, go ahead.
Today I'll be talking about one of the most infamous cooks in U.S. history. Few people know the name Mary Mallon. She was a simple cook just trying to do her job. Unfortunately, Mary had a problem. She was one of the few known healthy carriers of typhoid fever. After an investigation of a typhoid outbreak in the wealthy playground of Oyster Bay led back to her, Mary Mallon's life was about to change. When she refused to work with the health department, she was taken by force and given tests to confirm that she was indeed positive. Mary was placed on North Brother Island, the home of the State Hospital for People with Infectious Diseases, where she remained for 2 years. Mary was released in 1910 and told not to work as a cook. For a time, she took in laundry in order to make a living. The state of New York lost track of her around 1915 until an outbreak at a local hospital was traced back to the cook named Mrs. Brown, a.k.a. Mary Mallon. This time, Mary was taken back to the island, where she stayed until her death 26 years later. We have several books in the library about Typhoid Mary, a short, light biography by Anthony Bourdain, a more in-depth study by Judith Leavitt, upon which the DVD Typhoid Mary, The Most Dangerous Woman in America is based. Just in time for your holiday cooking, all are available at the library. Wash your hands and enjoy. Bill?
Okay. Legend has it, writer Karen Blixen, or Isaac Dennison, you know, Meryl Streep portrayed her in the movie Out of Africa, was complaining to her publisher that her novels weren't selling well in America. They sold everywhere else fine, but not in the USA. Isaac Dennison's publisher suggested she should write about food. Americans love food, he stated. Americans love good movies, too. And the story that Isaac Dennison went on to write was Babette's Feast, which in 1987 became a delightful film and was the first Danish movie to win Best Foreign Academy Award. Well deserved, I might add. The basic premise of the movie is this. In a barren and frigid coastal town in Denmark, live two devoutly religious sisters. One day, a woman named Babette shows up at the sister's house with a letter of reference recommending Babette as a housekeeper. Babette is played by Stefan Angeron. I really don't want to go into detail about the movie because it's one of the most enjoyable cinematic experiences I've ever had. The movie is deliberately paced. However, it has one of the best cinematic payoffs I've ever experienced. At the end, there is a feast. The only problem is you're not able to enjoy the meal at the end of the movie. However, you do get to enjoy the company. I highly recommend Babette's Feast. Crystal?
All right, I'm going to actually talk about food, for real. Back in my hometown, that's in Kentucky, for you all that don't know, Thanksgiving meals always consist of casseroles with cheese and crackers and maybe a little bit of broccoli underneath that. Green beans, you got your sweet potatoes with marshmallows burned on top, your roasted or deep fried turkey, or maybe both. And the meal always ends with pecan pie and carrot cake for dessert. This menu is not subject to change. But, dear podcast listeners, if you are cooking Thanksgiving dinner for the first time, or even looking for inspiration to jazz up your Thanksgiving feast, I highly recommend Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything, the Holiday Cooking Edition. Bittman's cookbooks are great because the recipes are simple to follow and the page layout is easy on the cook's eyes. This isn't your coffee table style cookbook with glossy professional photos that make the food look too pretty to eat. This is a DIY manual for cooks who aren't afraid to get down and dirty in the kitchen. This holiday cookbook covers not only Thanksgiving, but other holidays throughout the year. It breaks it down to cover hors d'oeuvres, salads, side dishes, and desserts. There are suggested Thanksgiving pairings for traditional and vegetarian feasts, as well as Thanksgiving for two. Now, this might sound a little random, but if you enjoy hummus and have never tried to make your own, there's a really easy recipe found in the hors d'oeuvre section of this book. I've made it several times, and it's always a hit at parties, at least late at night when there's nothing else left to eat. One last tip. If you've never listened to The Splendid Table's Turkey Confidential on Thanksgiving morning, turn down the volume on the Macy's Parade and tune into your local NPR station. It's a bit like SNL's Delicious Dish, but Lynn Rosetta Casper, the host, she really knows her stuff and has prevented many a Thanksgiving culinary tragedy. All right, Jesse, what you got?
I was going to talk about a song about food. I feel like as the token vegetarian here, I should probably have brought in a book about vegan Thanksgivings and saving turkeys and things like that, but I'm not going to do that. I'm actually going to talk about a song about eating chicken. In fact, Charles Mingus's song, Eat That Chicken. The CD that we have the recording of at the library is just called Charles Mingus. It's one of two called Charles Mingus, but this is the one that has Eat That Chicken on it. It's a, you know, in the catalog listed there. So you can just do a keyword search for Eat That Chicken, which you should probably just do all the time anyway. When Google, Bing, just put in Eat That Chicken and see what comes up every now and then. But it's a really, it's a, the CD that we have it on is a collection of, like, hits, if you could call it that. But it's a really weird song to throw in there because the rest of Mingus's music, he's a jazz bassist and composer. And he does goes a little out there sometimes. One of the songs on there is from a collection he has called, or an album called Black Saint and the Sinner Lady that's this, like, poetic ballet.
That's my favorite Mingus record.
Yeah, that was, yeah, it's awesome. But not one that you would think to pull something off of for a hits record, maybe. And then they throw this song in there, which was from an album, Oh Yeah, that Mingus recorded, that was just Mingus playing piano and singing, which was a bit of a step outside of his normal thing, playing bass and being a tyrannical conductor and director of the band. It's a really fun song. It's, I think, a tribute to Fats Waller. And it's just, you know, talking about eating chicken. And Charles Mingus is singing it, and it's really awesome. There's, like, not much else to say about it other than if you're looking for a good song about eating chicken, outside from Chibo Motto, if you want to know your chicken, you listen to Chibo Motto. If you want to eat your chicken, listen to this Mingus song. It's pretty awesome. He's just an all-around great person to listen to, aside from this song. We've got his autobiography, Beneath the Underdog, which is really, like, short on facts and high on just entertainment value. I don't even know what I can say about it that's appropriate to mention in the podcast, but there's just some amazing things that happen. It's told from the point of view of his personality splits as a child, and his, like, spirit walks away from him, and his spirit tells the story of his life, and it's got a foreword by his psychotherapist.
Like he's no longer responsible for anything.
Yeah, definitely.
Like his super ego is like, look at what that Charles Mingus is doing now.
It's got something for everybody. There's sex advice. There's advice on how not to kill yourself, which also involves sex. there's advice on how to be a pimp from Billie Holiday mixed in. It's an amazing book. It has nothing to do with food, just brought to mind by how awesome the song Eat That Chicken is. But just wanted to share with you guys, everybody should read that book. I've read it like 3 times. It's maybe one of the only books I've read more than once. Because it's amazing.
So earlier, this might not have a context, but I was talking, said, you know, well, that sounds kind of racist. And it was because I thought there was a Chibo Amado song, and the title of the song was Charles Mingus, Eat That Chicken.
Oh, no.
Because we said we had this whole conversation, well, how is that racist? Well, like, that changes
that
the
would
context.
Make it, yeah, no.
Exactly, right?
Yeah, that would make it racist.
Like, it sounds vaguely, that would be vaguely racist, right? If someone else had a song called Charles Mingus, Eat That Chicken.
That would be racist if you had
right?
a song called Charles Mingus,
yeah,
Eat That
so
Chicken.
Now you know where I'm coming from.
Bunch of Japanese girls with a song about Charles Mingus.
Exactly.
Eating that chicken.
Exactly. It was like something was lost in the translation.
I don't even know it.
Where do you go from there?
Dixie Chicken.
Little Feet is how you're thinking of
it.
That would be my Dixie Chicken.
That's what I was trying to think of. Yeah.
Okay, Clint just gave me the signal that I have to start, whether I'm ready to start or not. So we're going to talk about Rimdi, the new novel by Neal Stephenson, and myself and
Jesse
and Amanda
were the folks who read it, and the other folks are just anxiously awaiting the spoilers to find out if they want to read the book or not. And I'm just going to say, I hated this book.
Did you really?
I did. I mean, but I think if we talk about it, everyone will know, like, what it's about and whether or not you'd like it, so...
There are spoilers coming, too, by the way, so...
Yeah, there will be. There's no way that we cannot talk about the book and not have spoilers, so...
And I will say that I love the book, so... And
I really liked it a lot, also.
Yeah.
So Brian's in minority.
Yes. I just want to say, too, like, I hated this book, but, like, I recommend books to people, and this is the only response I ever get. I made it to, like, page 40, man. I had no idea what was going on. Like, and I just quit. So don't listen to my book recommendations. But at the end of our conversation, you'll know whether or not you want to read Rimdi or not.
Yeah.
So what is it about? It's about Richard Fortrast is the creator of a World of Warcraft, like, video game, okay? And his niece gets mixed up with the Russian mob, and then the Russian mobsters get mixed up with Chinese hackers, and the Chinese hackers get mixed up with Islamic jihadists, and then they get mixed up with British MI6 agents, and then they get mixed up with some seriously off-the-chart U.S. of A. gun nuts, and then you just kind of stir that around. And all those people snowball.
Canadian Mounties in there just for kicks.
There's some Canadian Mounties in there, too, and you just... That all those people just get snowballed together in an extremely crazy pinball of a plot, right? And then some of the action, right, takes place inside the video game world, and some of the other action takes place in the real world, right? So it's like mixes that up there together. So why'd you like it?
It's a thriller. It's hard not to just get wrapped up in the plot and, like, keep going. It's 1,000 pages, but it feels... You just breeze through it. I know I read it in, like, 3 days, and it was just... Yeah, I just breezed through it. It was amazing. But I was reading it, and I think I don't feel like this as much now as I did when I was first reading the book, that it was, like, a capital I important book. And it's I've sort of come down from that a little bit. But I think it really, like... I think... Stephenson has been criticized by some people about the book as, like, other books that he's written have dealt with very important issues like philosophy and mathematics and hacker culture, and that he's an important writer who writes about these things. And I think that this book deals, and this because it was like a thriller, he got criticized that it's a little lighter than what he usually is writing about. But I think there's sort of an amalgamation of 21st century culture that's going on that he's keen into. And that it's something that, in a way, people could read 20 years from now to get some understanding about this time period based on the book.
Have you read his other stuff?
I've read Anathem right after I read this. I read Anathem, like, right after I dove into it. And I started reading Quicksilver, but I've sort of let that fall by the wayside. I didn't like it as much.
It kind of seems to me that, like, it seems from which I've only read this one.
Yeah.
And it seemed like everybody talks about his other ones are like this highbrow, like intellectual hacker culture.
Yeah.
And it seems like this one has that aspect of it, but he kind of pulled it back. And, you know, in the age of 24 and the, you know, Jason Bourne movies, it's got that, but, you know, imposed on top of his hacker mentality and all that.
Well, I just thought it's like the way it mixes up like jihadism and Walmart culture and... the, like, losing yourself to virtual, massively multiplayer online role-playing games, that it sort of just, it was like a little cross-section of, like, post-9/11 America, in a way. And some of that, I think, is very sensationalized in the book. And that's what I think I've realized as, like, post-reading it, is that it's maybe not as important through the sensationalization of those things. But I know, I like you were saying earlier about the book, there's no good guys or bad guys. I think there are good guys and bad guys in this, but there's some insight into the bad guys, and I enjoyed that. I did get, there was a point when, like, everybody had a name except for the jihadists were just jihadists. Mm-hmm. But there was a moment where you really saw into the main jihadist, and, like, you could understand everybody's point of view in the book in a way that I thought was really interesting. Am I making a case for it?
Well, I mean, some of the things that you talked about are the reasons that I just didn't like it that much, right? And I said I hated it. That, I mean, if it would have been shorter, I just would have not liked it.
Yeah.
But the fact that it was really long, it was like, okay, this should have been, you know, 400 pages or whatever. Is, you know, that it's very sort. I described it as a meta thriller. It is kind of cartoony. Like, there's good guys and bad guys. Yeah. It's obvious who's going to win. There are some surprising deaths, though, like in a good movie. There are some surprising deaths, so... And, you know, there's this whole idea of, like... it's kind of reminded me of, like, Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, in the sense that it took this regular scenario and kind of gave it some life, but didn't, like, totally, like, flip the script on what it could be. But I want to talk about, like, the video game aspect of it, and do you think that eventually there will be, like, some good books about... massively multiplayer online video games, and like for me this wasn't that book, but I think this book would help explain it to people that don't play.
I'm not involved in any of those things, though.
No.
Well, see, I'm not.
I guess I listened to the podcast last month, mm-hmm. and I heard me say, like, I love Dungeons & Dragons, and it sounded like I was sarcastic, but I wasn't sarcastic. I mean, I love role-playing games, like tabletop role-playing games, and as like a tabletop role-playing game player, I lament that online role-playing games have basically sort of took that over, mm-hmm. and, like, tabletop role-playing games are just, like, this small little piece of the gaming world, right, that's kind of dying off.
Because I have not been immersed in the gaming world, and I thought that this was a pretty good place to start. Now, maybe if you're a hardcore gamer, you're like, oh my gosh, this is so, you know, kindergarten or something. There was stuff I had, like, I didn't know about gold mining, and I didn't, you know, I had to look up how people are actually physically making, you know, real-world dollars in this virtual world, and I didn't get any of that. So I thought, I mean, for someone who has no idea what's going on in the world, it was a good entrance into it, and yet it wasn't over my head. Like, I didn't get bogged down in all the gaming details. It kind of facilitated the story as opposed to slowing it down.
Yeah.
One thing I liked was that the way that technology sort of worked its way in organically into the book, mm-hmm. where you have some authors who have a lot of trouble, like, acknowledging that technology exists in their novels today, like these old white men writing books, like working cell phones and computers into things. And he uses Facebook and Twitter in the book in what felt like a kind of natural way to me, that it was just an aspect of these people's lives. He wasn't like trying to push it in like, this is 2011, I've got to put Facebook in there. It just felt like...
And it didn't feel like a pedestal he put it on. Oh, let's worship this technology. It was just an organic part of the story.
Just, you know, something that exists now and people mm-hmm. have
this is
to use.
It's a tool that we use.
I appreciated that. That was another thing about the... As like a cultural... What do you call it? Time capsule. Yeah, a time capsule. of this period. Like, it sort of showed the way that these things exist in our actual lives.
You know what the other film that it reminded me of is The Departed? And, like, the role of, like, mm-hmm. there's all these constant plot twists, and cell phones play a really big part in it. You know, there's, like cell phones play a very big part in this book. So what did you think about how it changes on, like, page 200? Like, the plot, like, radically changes. And this is, like, the first... That's when they...
They're, like, going to China, or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When they're going to break into the hacker's apartment, and they accidentally break into the militant jihadist apartment.
I hate when that happens.
So, exactly. So, but, like, that's the point where whenever the Russian mobsters who are going after the Chinese hackers break into the jihadist apartment mm-hmm. by accident, that's when I was like...
That's that old cliche.
Well, that's when I was like, you know, I don't care. I just don't care. But also, the book itself changes from, like, it's kind of slow and it's building up on mm-hmm. the characters, and it totally goes into James Bond explosions after that.
Absolutely.
And doesn't
crawling out of buildings on wires.
And doesn't,
collapsing.
Yeah, it doesn't turn off until the end. So, I mean, did you like that it went that hard, you know?
I didn't see it coming. I mean, I wasn't expecting the jihadist in the... I thought it would just be, you know, like some fat guys, you know, playing cards or something, you know? I mean, I wasn't expecting bomb-making jihadists in the apartment. So, I think that... had that not been there, the book could have been 400 pages and maybe you wouldn't have hated it so much. But I mean, I think because they put that there, the only place I thought that kind of dragged was when they got everybody out of China. Like they had, cause I guess maybe because you had that big, oh my gosh, we just blew up the world and now we're all in this country illegally. How do we get home? And I thought that because there were so, they broke them up into so many different groups. Like everybody kind of had their buddy. And it's like seeing all these people, like I thought that part, I was like, okay, just, you know, go home at that point. And that was the only part after, but I mean, everything else was just nonstop action.
Yeah, I enjoyed that aspect of it, that like thriller part, because I know I don't read a lot of thrillers, and I'm going to sound, I always end up making myself sound really snobby on these things, but I guess because I am a snob. But I described Codex by Lex Grossman as a Da Vinci Code for smarter people, and this is kind of like Tom Clancy for smarter people, yeah, a little bit. So, and I'm in a, I'm falling into that trap of denigrating people who might be listening to this podcast, who I serve every day in the library. But, but I think, I mean, I'm not a person who's
we just lost all our Tom Clancy fans.
They just
pulled their earbuds out of their iPod so hard.
That I was with you with the Chibamata jokes, but it's like it's. I don't really read Tom Clancy books because there's just, it's not interesting to me, that thriller aspect. But this, in the way that he does the thriller, I enjoyed it. I don't know. Because it's all frou-frou'd up for smarty pants internet people, and that's what I am, frou-frou smarty pants internet person.
You did tell me earlier you're going to replace the glass on your cell phone yourself, which is, that's thinking about it. Like Neil Stephenson would do that,
yeah,
I think, for sure.
Yeah, he would rebuild the whole thing.
That's one thing, though, like, Neil Stephenson is a real, like, cult of personality, I think, and I don't really get his personality. I don't really enjoy that aspect, like, reading about him, like, playing with guns and making his own swords and stuff like that. I think that's silly.
Well, me too. Yeah. I don't really get his call to personality either. And I don't really want to go back and read his other books now that
really?
I've read it.
I really thought Anathem was really awesome.
Yeah.
I liked it better than I liked Rimdi.
I want to read the crypt. What is it? The
Cryptonomicon.
I think that one's not, but that one may be over my head. But I thought this one might be too, and it wasn't.
I think this is. I've heard this is like a call back to Cryptonomicon, from having not read it, but that's what I've heard from reviews I've read.
Well, like two other, you know, Cory Doctorow is probably like a part of the Neil Stephenson personality cult, right? Mm-hmm. So he wrote this book For the Win, which I think was like very similar kind of like real world game world battles and international intrigue. And then he also wrote a book, Little Brother, which I think you get a lot of the same hacker stuff that's in Cryptonomicon, but in a far more
palatable.
Yeah, shorter.
Easier to read.
But if you liked, you know, if you liked.
I like this.
Yeah,
one,
go
though,
for
so
it.
I might
dig right in, right?
The descriptions I've read of For the Win are sort of like the book that you think that Rimdi is going to be when you first start reading it, and then it turns out to be not that at all.
Well, For the Win is really about like labor versus management. Like the gold miners in For the Win form a union, where like the gold mining in Rimdi is just kind of like the
Chinese kids making money.
Yeah, it's like a foil. It's part of the background, you know.
Yeah.
Because even like Marlin, the one Chinese hacker that creates the Rimdi virus, we don't really get to know him that much.
No, not very well.
Yeah. His character ended up being named that. I have a question for the guys, because there was a little bit of romance. Maybe I just picked up on it because I'm a girl. But I mean, I didn't know how much that you guys, that he noticed it, if he liked it or.
With the Hungarian hacker?
Yeah, I mean, there was just kind of, like, they kind of hinted that he never really got there and had romance. But, I mean, I wonder if it's just because I was sensitive to that, because that's normal, you know, I read romances. And
well, the end, their romance blossoms and stuff, right?
Yeah.
I could tell it was there. Maybe it's from being a nerdy, unloved.
Hacker guy.
I'm not a hacker.
Oh,
anyways,
computer
but,
guy.
But, yeah, I could see the, like, blossoming infatuation within him throughout the book. It felt real to me from personal infatuation experience.
Yeah, it was there. Between Songer and Zula, it was right there the whole time, right? And there was a contrast, too, against...
Well, and Olivia and Sokolov were kind of...
Well, that was,
they were the on again, off again of the...
They were...
That was the James Bond romance, though, right?
So, yeah, but he was the Russian guy that...
Yeah.
That was more obvious. But now that we started talking about all these characters, right? So which characters did you like the most, you know, of the gang?
I think the Sokolov was my favorite.
I liked Sokolov. Yeah, and Kongsner, whatever, the Hungarian.
Yeah, I
liked
him.
I was pronouncing it Songer.
Songer?
Yeah.
So is the like legless Forthrath? John or James?
John was
the legless one. I liked him.
Yeah. That was a really interesting aspect that they didn't play up, that he had gone to Vietnam and lost his legs, but his brother had, you know, dodged the draft and then became
a billionaire
businessman. It's like, you know, this weird tension that they, it was kind of there, but then he got caught up with explosions and
John getting beaten with his
guns and stuff. And of course, Ezzy's kind of really sad. The guy with no legs is the guy that ends up getting killed by the terrorists, right? So it's like, huh? It's kind of strange.
Yeah. Which that was the only, I mean, because we had seen John kind of on and off, and then right at the end, like, you could just see that's how he had been in Vietnam, like, how he was when he was, you could just get that really brief, and then it's over.
Yeah. I think he does a good job, too, making all the gun nut people seem likable and real, and I don't think, especially in, like, literary fiction, right? I don't think that he'd
fundamentalist.
Yeah, the fundamentalist gun nuts would not would actually be given as fair treatment, you know.
They saved the day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But still, like, Solokov still says, well, these are the American Taliban, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that plays a big part in it, too, because the actual Islamic jihadists, right? It's one of the themes is where they don't understand the cultures that they're in. That's kind of one of the themes because the people in China don't. When the Westerners go to China, they don't know what's going on, you know, and because they don't, because the jihadists don't know American culture, they don't realize if they're in Idaho that everyone there has a gun, right? And it's loaded, and they know how to use
Idaho,
it, right? Yeah. So
is that a stereotype of? That's something I don't know. I've never been to Idaho. Is that?
Yeah,
I think it's kind of that, like Montana, like northern Montana and Idaho, that's kind of the...
Okay. Honestly, if you're not in a city in the West, that's what it's like, in my experience, right?
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, too, I think that, I mean, in this age of, you know, female empowerment, I really liked how Zula kind of bugged me, but I liked how capable, like every time she got away or something, like she did it. She didn't have to wait for some guy to come save her. I mean, ladies, this woman killed a man with Love Actually. I mean, you can't beat that. You know, you're watching Love Actually, some guy comes in to attack you, and you pull out the DVD, and you break it in half, and you stab him with it. I mean, seriously, that's...
That happened in the book?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, no, isn't that awesome?
That's one of our favorites.
So, I know. Like it's like my really favorite movie, because it's also a weapon. So, I mean, I really wasn't... I mean, because even once you think, like, you know, Buffy or other, you know, female empowerment, there's always some man looking in the background to save the day, and she really didn't have that. She got herself out of some pretty hot spots, so I thought that was... good on Stevenson's part.
Yeah, and even the parts song are, even though like he's the romantic interest and they hook up in the end, I mean, he never really rescues her at all. Matter of fact, she kind of saves him a few times, you know, so. And it's interesting, Zula always gets out of her scenarios, but she doesn't have these crazy, like, mercenary MacGyver skills that Sokolov has, right?
Yeah, seriously.
So, you know, so.
Which is even more impressive how she used Love Actually, because Sokolov, he'd have been there at the beginning, and he'd have started with that. She kind of had to improvise as she got through.
Yeah.
He'd have, like, made the DVD himself and with a little pocket knife. And swum underwater to get there.
Sorry.
Like that, but Russian and not... Who's the character that plays Will... What's his name?
Oh, not Will.
Will Forte.
I was going to say Will Ferrell, and that wasn't right. Yeah, not Will Forte. So
I just wanted to talk about, like, some of the other... I described it as a meta-thriller. So I think there were some aspects where, like, the video game world mimicked the, like, the real world within the textual real world. And then there was some meta-fictional stuff, too, in the sense that inside the scenes in the game, there was, like, this Deus Ex Machina kind of scenario that just fixes the problems in the game world. But inside the plot of the book in the real world, the teams of players are like the teams of players in the game. Mm-hmm. And even though we don't see the hand of the author, like all the absurd MacGyver stuff that happens is God's in the machine, even though we don't see the author, right? And even though I think, too, that Richard Forthrast is, I mean, for me, in my head, I think it's Neal Stephenson, right?
I think he's the closest one to him.
Yeah, yeah. So there was all that was going on. And I thought, that, well, that's pretty interesting, but it was too long. Yeah. And it kind of made me want to read, like, I guess you talked about smart spy thrillers. I kind of wanted to read John le Carré, maybe even like Daniel Silva to see how it compares. Because one of the other things I was
reading. Have you read Daniel Silva?
No.
Because Daniel Silva is more like Tom Clancy than.
Well, the other reason I even say that is because there's the art subplot, and yeah. I studied art, so like I would get the references, right? Right?
Okay, then we'll put him in between. Like, John might be up here, and then.
Who's the snob now,
What? I studied art at the Dixon County Community Center. I don't know. I apologize, Dixon County. I love you. Don't slash the tires on my
truck. Now we're down to two listeners.
I've met many librarians from Dixon County. They're great. They're not lazy like me. What else was I going to say?
I'm scared to death. Sorry.
Lost myself into my own joke.
Well, we're getting the 5-minute flash.
totally. Oh, the other book that I was reading at the same time was this book called How to Write a Damn Good Thriller by James Frey, who's just totally, he makes this career out of giving lectures and writing books on basically, like, this is how you write a bestseller.
And I actually have a factory, lied, right? About his drug addiction.
I think that's a different guy.
That's a different James Frey.
Yeah,
yeah, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's a different. This guy's name might be James Frey. I don't know. I'll put it in the show notes. And I actually was curious because I don't read thrillers. I was like, well, let's see how you write one, right? So I was reading about it, and he has all these elements. Like, this is how you write a thriller. And I was comparing what he says to Rimdi. And I was like, yeah, I could see the things that Rimdi has and the things that Rimdi doesn't have. And, you know, it's like I'm thinking to myself, well, Stevenson needs an editor. And then I thought back to even, like, this is more of a crime novel, but No Country for Old Men, which very much was like sort of a literate thriller, a literate crime novel. And it was amazing, I think, a work of art. And it did have all the elements that Frey says you should have. So, but depends what you're into. Can't end on that.
I'm just saying, that's kind of a sad ending.
So we're talking
Happy
about,
Thanksgiving.
We got to talk about the title.
Oh, yeah.
So I saw on Goodreads, there was like an hour-long live interview with Neal Stephenson talking about the book. And the interviewer pronounced it Rimdi, and you could tell that Stevenson didn't like that, but he just kind of shrugged his shoulders and went along with it.
Did he say it at some point?
I think he did say it at some point, but it just seemed weird to me. Because I thought maybe it is, the title is pronounced Reamed because of that line from Lenin that Ivanov says about who does whom, right? Yeah. So there's the idea of like, because kind of like The Departed, it's a novel where everyone is just screwing each other. Like, you know what I mean? And then who's gonna get the last move in, right, to win the chess game?
Well, see, and at one point, too, it mentions the play on how you always have those computer files that are readme.
Oh, yeah,
you know, so, I mean, and then, like, I don't know what the hardback one, the one Jesse and I read, like, the letters for read are all one color, and the letters for me are all one color, so they just are interposed.
Yeah, it's more...
So it's a thinker.
I think, it makes it more, more obvious, right, that this is a play on that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I have no thoughts on how to say the name of the book.
I just call it Stevenson's book. A cheat.
He changed his name to an unpronounceable symbol.
So, Crystal, do you want to read it?
I might give it a shot. I mean,
it sounds really complicated, doesn't
you
it?
You got her with that Love Actually slicing.
See, that was for
a
out there. There's no woman in this world that hasn't loved Love Actually.
I just want to say that she does not use it to slash his throat, but another part of his body.
Yes.
You've been listening to the Pop-matic Podcast. For more information, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
How do you spell www? Wait, and don't forget, hey, listen, if you actually do listen to the podcast, I don't know why you
we
would.
Love you. We love you.
There's weird images of me as the machinist. But leave your comments. We want to give you some feedback. You tell us what you like, what you don't like. You know, we'll read books that we don't like just to talk about them for you. We're nice that way. And go back and listen to Bill's interviews. They're really good.
Thank you.
And stuff.
Best in Nashville.
Exactly.